I'm here filling Deirdre Mulligan's shoes. Deirdre was unable to make it at the last minute, and they're very big shoes to fill. I decided, rather than recycling a set of slides that I've given before, which would be boring for me and, I don't know, therefore not so interesting for you, I actually thought I'd present to you some thoughts based on the experience I had working in government and working around government on the relationship between the public policy-making process and what we know from our research on these issues. I want to suggest to you that we have a real technology policy gap that needs to be closed. My experience both as an advocate outside of government, as a researcher trying to influence government, and as a part of a decision-making process inside government, is that these internet policy issues that we face are increasingly important. Obviously, I don't think that there's much question about that, but that the research base that we have to draw on, the intellectual base that we have to draw on, is really somewhat lacking. But please take this kind of as a keynote in the form of a workshop presentation. I'm going to throw a bunch of ideas out, and I'll look forward to your reactions. To give you a sense of my sense of the state of internet policy making in the US and really all around the world, think about a couple of analogies. Imagine if we were having the environmental policy debate that we're having today, the debate about climate change and other kinds of pollution questions. Imagine we were having that debate if we had no way to measure carbon in the atmosphere, if we had no way to detect ozone concentrations or study what happens when ozone is thicker or thinner. Imagine if we had no understanding of key toxins that are introduced into the environment, no understanding of how they affect other living things, other non-living things. Imagine we didn't even know they were necessarily toxins. Think about, in other contexts, the Federal Reserve Bank, which is responsible for setting interest rates that, among other things, have a huge effect on the housing market. Imagine they had no idea what happened when they raised or lowered the rates. Imagine the FDA, which has to approve drugs, had no methodology whatsoever for testing the impact on drugs. If you can wind yourself back to points when we couldn't even begin to answer any of those kind of questions or even analyze any of those questions, I want to suggest to you that, to a first approximation, that's actually where we are with internet policy making. The issues are really important, but we have very little idea how to really analyze them carefully. Now, the cynical among you, I think, might say, well, that's the way all policymaking happens. No one has any idea what they're doing. All the numbers that are thrown around, all the analysis that's done in the name of economics or climate chemistry or whatever else is all nonsense or ideologically driven. But I would say that at least we have the basis in those more mature policy debates to have an argument about what the right models are, about whether data is accurate, et cetera. So I want to examine with you a little bit a couple of the key internet policy questions that have come up over the last couple years, and look at our state of knowledge and how we might improve that. I think the imperative to understand these issues more carefully is really clear. Study in, I think, 2012 found that the internet and information infrastructure generally is responsible for about 25% of GDP growth in the top 15 OECD countries. So that's the rich part of the world. But it says that the rich part of the world is quite dependent on the decisions that we make, on the way this part of the economy develops. The internet is a funny entity to measure from an economic perspective because it has such a broad horizontal effect. There are so many sectors that are dependent upon it. But if you took the internet as a sector, it would be about 3.5% of U.S. GDP. That puts it somewhere between real estate and agriculture. So it's a big part of our economy. And beyond just the economic impact of the internet, environment. It's obviously key to democracy, key to the way we do science, key to our access to knowledge, helps lots of people get married. You know, it's important for all kinds of reasons. I'm going to take a critical look at these four internet policy issues. And I guess I'll say just as a kind of a caveat that in many cases, I'm personally quite happy with the direction that we've ended up on most of these issues. But I'm professionally dissatisfied with the way we got to the answers. So I'm going to take a somewhat critical look at these questions, not because I actually disagree with the results, but because I'm somewhat skeptical that if the reasoning and the policy process was subject to a greater rigor, we might not get to the right results, or we might even really know what to do at all. So I'm going to look at the question of SOPA, the Stop Online Privacy Act. Some of you will know a lot about it. Some of you have never heard of it. It was an online copyright debate. Net neutrality, some current big data privacy questions, and just look a little bit at the way our debate about surveillance and cybersecurity is developing. What I'm going to suggest to you is that underneath the way that we've approached a lot of these issues is a certain kind of libertarian technology design hypothesis that you can't touch the design of the internet, that it's sacrosanct. And there are good reasons for that, because it works pretty well. But I think we're going to have to start to look at that. I think that hypothesis is going to come under increasing question. And I'll close just by talking about some very broad research questions that I think would help to close this gap. So many of you will remember in 2011, 2012, I guess starting 2010, there was a debate about a series of legislative proposals which came to be known as the Stop Online Piracy Act. These were proposals that were designed to deal with what I think is a very real problem, that there is infringing content, both copyright infringing content and material for sale that infringes trademark or other intellectual property rights, that's available for sale or access in the U.S., but is hosted outside the U.S. So it makes it hard for U.S. law enforcement to go after the providers of that illegal or infringing content. And there was a proposal, a legislative proposal, which took a number of forms to deal with this problem, among other things, by creating a mechanism for the U.S. Legal system, perhaps in the form of courts, perhaps in the form of just administrative officials, to instruct DNS operators to remove DNS entries that would point to that infringing content. In other words, it was thought of in a kind of a quaint sense as a way of reestablishing borders. You can control the sale of illegal physical goods that come from abroad into the U.S. By stopping them at the border. That's why we have a customs system. And people who are in the law enforcement arena said, well, we need that for the internet, so let's use the DNS to limit access to this sort of content. Now, I'm not going to get into the whole debate about how effective that would be or not, but suffice it to say, it became a huge political issue, and this is kind of the characteristics of all the issues I'm going to talk about are as follows. They're technically pretty complex. They involve questions about potentially about affecting in one way or the other the way a pretty complex networked environment works. But at the same time, they're issues that have attracted increased commercial attention and increased grassroots advocacy attention. So groups like Fight to the Future, the Electronic Frontier Foundations, other organizations have started to mount actually very successful online advocacy campaigns that attract the public attention to these issues and do tend to take somewhat sort of caricatured views of the issue in order to make the issue simple enough for the average member of the average grassroots to understand. So the opposition to SOPA, which turned on a bunch of pretty complicated technical questions, got reduced to a very simple catchphrase: don't break the internet. The advocates said SOPA would break the internet, so we shouldn't pass it. What does it mean to break the internet? Well, it's really not quite clear. There was some more careful thought put into this question by a group of very distinguished engineers, more or less the who's who of the kind of original IETF and number of both academic and commercial engineers and computer scientists, who in fact said about SOPA that if it were passed, as they wrote here in this letter to Congress, that it would risk fragmenting the internet's global DNS and have other capricious technical consequences. They didn't exactly specify what those were. But they were worried. They had an intuition, and we have to acknowledge a very well-informed intuition, that mucking with the DNS, that removing DNS entries for policy reasons could destabilize the entire environment. And there were a whole bunch of arguments, which I won't go into, about why that would be. But it presented policymakers with a really hard problem. Because on the one hand, we had very kind of dramatic calls from the entertainment industry saying, you know, our content's being stolen all over the world, we're losing all kinds of money, jobs are being lost. It was a set of arguments that one had to pay attention to as a policymaker, even if you didn't necessarily agree with them. You have to acknowledge that they had some real grievances. And then on the other hand, you had grassroots voices which said the internet's going to break, and you had, again, very distinguished, trustworthy engineers saying that there are going to be these very unusual consequences of what was probably just going to be a handful of legal orders that says remove a few entries from a few domain name servers here and there. They said that could destabilize the entire DNS. And while they said it with great authority, they had no data whatsoever to back it up. They didn't have data. They didn't have a model. They didn't really have anything except their word and their intuition, which one had to take seriously to a certain extent. And interestingly, as this issue kind of moved through the policy process, eventually the White House felt that it had to express an opinion about it. I was there at the time and was responsible for this. In the end, when the president put out a statement saying what his opinion was going to be about this particular legislative proposal, he issued what amounted to a veto threat that said if Congress passes a law like SOPA that has certain characteristics to it, the president was likely to veto it. And it was based, in fact, on the analysis from this very distinguished group of engineers, also some engineers inside the various security agencies who looked at the question. But I have to say, it was an incredibly awkward moment because we had to make a decision that balanced, on the one hand, a very real statement of harms from the intellectual property holders, with a speculation about what would happen to a very complex global system, which has not been particularly well studied, if that law was passed. And as this statement reflects, in the end, the assessment was that it wasn't worth the risk, that if there was even a risk that in fact we could destabilize the DNS, that by removing entries from certain name servers we would force people to go use other name servers, perhaps less reliable name servers, perhaps name servers outside of the United States, that would have a whole series of bad consequences that were not worth the risk associated with whatever the benefit was of passing the law. But it was done based on a set of intuitions. as I said, well-informed intuitions, but not based on any kind of empirical, testable, measurable analysis. There are other issues where this happens. Again, the net neutrality issue that probably many of you know about. For a number of years, there's been debate about whether internet service providers should be allowed to or prevented from treating different types of traffic from different sources in discriminatory manners. Should you privilege certain kinds of traffic based on its the characteristics of the traffic, based on the fact that the source of the traffic pays you more money, based on the fact that you like this one source or don't like another source? Should ISPs be allowed to do this? It's a very important question. And again, like the SOPA issue, it's a technically really complex question that has been reduced to a couple of buzzwords. This wasn't don't break the internet. The buzzword here is no fast lanes. The suggestion being that all internet traffic should be treated exactly the same way. Now, anyone who knows anything about the internet works knows that that's completely ridiculous, that the internet has never worked that way, and that if we forced it to work that way, it would largely grind to a halt. But the slogan from the grassroots, and again, I'm pretty sympathetic to the view that we have to make sure that there's not unreasonable discrimination by ISPs, because I think there are all kinds of risks associated with that. But the debate has come down to this slogan, no fast lanes. Now, a somewhat more careful technical analysis gives you a kind of a more nuanced view. My colleague at MIT, Dave Clark, and some of his colleagues at UCSD have done some really outstanding work measuring internet-wide congestion. They just happen to be doing these measurements as the debate between Netflix and Comcast was heating up. Those of you who pay attention to these things will know that Netflix service started slowing down considerably for most customers, but particularly for customers of Comcast, in some part because of the way that Netflix and Comcast were provisioning their interconnection relationship. And there was a debate that Netflix said they should be able to connect to the Comcast network, bring whatever amount of traffic Comcast customers demanded without charge, and Comcast said, no, you've got to pay us because you're causing a large amount of traffic. You're causing a large amount of congestion on our interconnection links, and that's a violation of the norms of how internet interconnection peering has typically worked. And so Dave and Casey and colleagues actually went out and studied this, and in fact found that, interestingly enough, for the net neutrality debate overall, there's almost no pervasive congestion on the internet. The internet works reasonably well, so a lot of the net neutrality debate may be a debate over nothing, because most ISPs, most content providers, kind of have figured out how to engineer their traffic so that it works in a reasonably reliable and uncongested way. However, looking at the Netflix Comcast interconnection points, you find, or the interconnection between Netflix's transit ISPs and Comcast, you actually found quite considerable and persistent congestion, and you'll notice it kind of growing here as you go from left to right, and then in early March it drops off very suddenly, and that's the point at which Netflix decided to start to pay Comcast whatever they negotiated with Comcast to handle the interconnection. We did a and this leads to kind of a bunch of questions for policymakers. This doesn't really answer the policy question. On the one hand, it says, different kinds of interconnection patterns actually may impose some costs on different providers, and it may be reasonable for those who bring a lot of traffic to a peering point, to an interconnection point, to actually pay for that. But But this is really one of the first times that anyone had actually studied in a public way the details of these interconnection patterns as a way of informing the net neutrality debate. We did a presentation of these results over the summer as the FCC was debating a lot of these issues. And in fact, both sides of the debate urged us not to present this paper because the data was confusing. It didn't really support either side very cleanly. And what it also revealed, frankly, was that Casey and Dave have had to work incredibly hard to get access to this data, because much of the information you need to actually measure congestion is found inside ISP's networks. It's not necessarily publicly observable. So one of the things we learned here is that to even get the data that you would want to have in order to make a thoughtful policy decision about these net neutrality questions, there has to be a certain amount of transparency into the way that ISPs operate, and we don't have that at this point. Another issue that's obviously gotten a huge amount of public attention is the question of consumer privacy. The White House, over the last couple of years after I left, did a really outstanding analysis of some of the privacy questions involved in large-scale analytics, so-called big data, and actually did a great policy process that paid a lot of attention to both the technical and commercial nuances of the issue, rather than just cook up a quick policy decision. The White House actually ran a series of workshops around the country at three different universities to hear from academics, industry advocates, and it was a really, really very thoughtful process. And one of the conclusions they came to was that there's a real risk of discrimination in the use of large-scale analytic tools in making decisions, whether they're financial decisions about what financial benefits are available to people or what have you. And this was a terrific, I think, a terrific and very thoughtful result. But here again, you had the White House and the Federal Trade Commission actually did a parallel study of big data issues. And all they could both say was that there was a risk of discrimination. They didn't really say whether there was actually any discrimination happening. And I actually have no idea. I don't even have a gut feeling about whether there's discrimination happening or not. It's a real question. What it reveals is this is yet another issue where we really just don't have the data or the mechanisms to analyze a really critical internet policy question. The final issue I want to talk about is one that's been around really an awfully long time. We've had debates since even before the commercial internet about the public policy implications of access to cryptographic technology. Those of you with really long memories will remember that it used to be illegal to export software with, as Dave, to export software with any reasonable strength encryption. And this was in some part because domestic law enforcement didn't want there to be widely available encryption because it would thwart their ability to conduct electronic surveillance. That's a debate that's been happening since the late 1980s, mid-1980s, really. It's come back again very recently, in some part thanks to all the Snowden revelations. And recently, earlier this year, Apple announced that their new mobile operating system design would make it technically infeasible for Apple to provide law enforcement any assistance with getting access to data that would be on iPhones or other iOS devices. The data on those devices would be encrypted by default, and Apple would have no way of recovering keys in order to help law enforcement, even in the event that law enforcement had a warrant. Google, not surprisingly, with Android, followed along really quickly. And what this did is it brought back an old policy debate in the late 1990s. In the late 1990s, the Clinton administration had a proposal for something that was called the Clipper chip. It was a key escrow proposal that would, where what they had hoped would was to kind of split the difference between those who wanted strong encryption and law enforcement and national security that wanted to be able to continue to do electronic surveillance. That you could use strong encryption, but you'd have to escrow your keys in some way or another with some entity. Maybe it was a bank. Maybe it was a government agency. That was never quite figured out. This was actually an early example of I think really useful, careful technical analysis of a complex internet policy question. This group of very distinguished cryptographers and computer scientists got together and looked at the properties of these key escrow proposals and came to the conclusion that it was fundamentally insecure to build any kind of key escrow system, and that at least at the scale that would be necessary to solve the government's needs. And this was a very strong paper. It had an enormous effect on the public policy debate. It more or less was the nail in the coffin on encryption on key recovery proposals. But it was a kind of a very abstract, sort of speculative analysis about what might happen if you built a system this large. There wasn't the normal kind of analysis that you would have of a crypto system or any large system. Again, I think it was raised a lot of very thoughtful questions. It was not unlike the engineers who wrote about SOPA saying, we think if you do something to a system this big, here's what will happen. And we know a fair amount about these systems, and so be careful, is sort of the form of the analysis. And I think that what we see now in response to the Apple and the Google announcement, the FBI director gave a very impassioned speech about how terrible it would be if they couldn't get access to data on iPhones. The head of GCHQ, the UK kind of FBI NSA equivalent, UK surveillance body, said that social networks and kind of this whole mobile ecosystem were effectively the command and control networks for terrorists, and they better start to realize that and take responsibility. And so we're back in this very difficult debate where we have some obviously very hard policy questions. You have the Washington Post saying, well, just try to figure something out. Just there must be some technical magic that you could do here to solve this problem, and I think that where we are is we still don't really know a whole lot about the dynamics of very large scale systems like this. So we're going to have a debate that is in many ways more ideological than technically well informed. A lot of what has motivated at least one side of the internet policy discussion has been what I think of as the libertarian design hypothesis. It's a hypothesis that and Cory Doctorow just wrote a piece in Wired at the end of last year. It's a very, very, very compelling piece in which he says that you really cannot legislate the design of computer systems because it somehow makes them fundamentally insecure and I don't know, violates a principle that he kind of asserts is self-evident, that general purpose computing systems have to be allowed to function without restraint, and that if we restrain them through legal mechanisms, that we will somehow cause harm. Now, I happen to think what's behind this sentiment is actually a policy judgment, which says we don't want that the great thing the internet has done is that it has made us all much more free. It has made information much more widely accessible, and in fact, it has also shifted the balance somewhat between citizens and government, perhaps in the favor of citizens. I'm sympathetic to a lot of those things, but in this libertarian design hypothesis, this suggestion that if you monkey with the design of any of these big infrastructures that we depend on, whether it's iOS or the DNS or other parts of the internet environment, that will cause some kind of catastrophic harm, that we can't do it because it would be technically a bad idea, I think is an increasingly weak argument. It may be that we shouldn't do it for all the public policy reasons behind it, but I think that we're coming to the end of the point where we can say there can be no legal expectations on the way information infrastructure operates, simply because we're too dependent on this infrastructure now, and we're going to have to start developing, I think, somewhat more nuanced answers to a lot of these questions. We may get to the same place, but I think many of the values behind this libertarian ideal of the internet design are values that we should hold on to, but I think we're going to have to hold on to them based on a much stronger set of research. So here are just three very, very high-level ways in which I think we can work to close this internet technology policy gap, and I'm going to add a fourth just based on the previous speech, actually. I think that it's really clear that our ability to measure and instrument many of the large-scale systems that we have, whether they're systems that are involving complex use of personal information or large network systems, such as questions that arise in the net neutrality debate, is really quite limited. I know the NSF has supported some network measurement work. I hope there's a lot more of that coming. I think it's extraordinarily important, and I think there's a really important dialogue that has to happen between network engineers who want to study properties of networks and policymakers who I think are going to have to step in and take some role in providing increased transparency into this infrastructure that we all depend on. Many of the policy questions, SOPA and some of the key escrow questions that we discussed, I think really depend on understanding the behavior of large-scale complex systems. Now, we've got lots of expertise in the engineering world, in control theory, in other kinds of approaches to understanding the behavior and the stability and resilience and reliability of large-scale systems. I think we need to be doing a lot more of that kind of research, specifically in order to inform public policymakers, because the policy process will necessarily have more and more contact with the operation of these large infrastructures that we depend on, and I think we just need to understand what those dynamics are going to be like. I think adding in the socio-technical aspect of these systems, adding in the behavior of individuals at a large scale in these systems is especially important. The key question that the SOPA debate turned on, the question of what would happen if you removed some DNS entries to limit access to foreign infringing sites, foreign infringing content, what would individuals do? Would they open up their settings or control panel and find themselves point themselves to a different name server in order to get to those sites? How many individuals would do that? 0.1%, 30%? That would have a really big effect on the policy decisions made, but we don't know anything about how individuals are actually behaving in these environments. So we have to understand and model not just the technical systems, but also the individual behavior that happens at scale in those systems. And finally, I think to get to the right questions, we really need to work harder on mechanisms for interdisciplinary collaboration. I know that NSF and SATSI in particular has been a big supporter of this. I think there's still a lot of work to do here, mostly because I think the professional structures of a lot of the disciplines that need to work together are still pretty far apart. The professional incentives, the career advancement incentives are awfully different, makes working together, putting together joint projects complex. I guess I'd add the fourth, just based on the last talk about cybersecurity education and STEM education. I know we're devoting more and more time at MIT to thinking about how we can train our students, particularly our CS students, to be able to function in various public policy environments. More and more companies, as many of you know, actually want to hire technically skilled students who can work on policy questions. The government needs to hire people like that. I think we need to think about how we structure our academic institutions to make sure we're addressing those kinds of questions. I'm not necessarily in favor of creating a new discipline out of whole cloth, but I think in many ways, as we've done with fields like environmental studies, we've worked out ways for disciplines, chemists, physicists, engineers, to work together on questions of climate, of environmental impact, and I think we need to do a lot of that in this field. So a lot of this is based on my experience spending just a couple years in government, but it was a couple years during which the profile of these internet issues really rose quite dramatically, where even in 2008, 2009, looked at from the perspective of the congressional leadership, the White House leadership, these were relatively marginal technical questions. They were regarded as kind of cool, and people were making a lot of money around them, so there was attention to them, but they weren't integrated into the policy decision-making process. I saw that change just in the few years that I was in government, and I think that continues, so that you now have high-level attention from senior government officials, the most senior government officials, who really, I think, are in need of guidance from the research community about how to understand decision making in on these really important questions. So, a lot to do here, and be happy to take some questions. Thanks.
I'm going to take the moderator's prerogative and push Nick out of the way to ask the first question and ask people to line up. First, a really brief story that in the early 2000s, I was responsible for a crypto export for a medium-sized software company, and they would ask me questions whenever they were getting ready to export it. And one day I got a call. We're doing a demo for the North Korean nuclear program. Is it okay if we give them a copy of the software? And I said, no way in hell. And a few minutes later, they called back and they said, oops, we misread it. It was the South Korean hydroelectric program. I said, that's a little bit different. North Korea, South Korea, what's the difference? Okay. It's amazing that people who are not involved in some of the policy issues don't always understand that a small difference like North Korea and South Korea and hydroelectric versus nuclear can have an impact on crypto.
Anyway,
my question is, you've pointed to some of the technology gaps. In my non-NSF role, I am part of USACM, and I've been for many years. Do things like USACM and other groups that ordinary people in this room who are technical experts but not policy experts, do they have a difference, and what do they get listened to by policymakers? I guess I'll...
Absolutely. Absolutely they get listened to. I guess my observation is that the bar for having influence is going to raise and is going to rise and needs to rise. I think that to a large extent, what we've had up until now, for the most part, is we've had computer scientists, engineers who are interested in these issues, who I think, on in a kind of a public-spirited way, show up and say, here's what I think. It's often not enormously related to the research they do. Maybe it is. But we have to move from, here's what I think because I'm smart and a distinguished person, to here's a body of research that's been published in peer-reviewed journals that is based on, you know, accepted scientific methodology, and that can really stand up to a debate. The debate that I would observe, I think you know, USACM, the IEEE, are and many universities are looked to as a kind of authoritative, unbiased source of information, but candidly, very often that information ends up being opinion. And that's better than nothing. It's good to do that, and I think, you know, scientist opinions matter a lot, but we should also have some science.
Okay, so let me slightly push back on that, because, again, in my non-NSF role, I've done a lot of work in voting and election equipment and stuff like that, and what I found is the subtlety of, well, things could break if blah, 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 like the example you gave that was the more nuanced than don't break the internet. When you talk to elected officials, it's like, why all the weasel words and maybes and coulds? We want a yes, no, this will be good, this will be bad. Don't give us that, all those nuances, because we don't understand it.
Right. Well, look, ultimately, policymakers push for a yes no because they have to decide yes no. I mean, they have to do something, so they want to know there's support for the thing they're doing. They don't want to just have a debate. They need to make a decision. But I guess what I'm arguing for is that debate ought to start with more of a scientific basis. And then there'll be all the usual discussion, well, that's not reliable, or your data's wrong, or whatever it is, and that's fine. We should be at that point. I see Salil here, so I'm not going to give the example of his outstanding work, but maybe you will.
No. Thanks, Danny. This is really thought-provoking. What I want to ask about is, you know, one feature that distinguishes, I think, a lot of the issues that the computer scientists in this room think about from some of the other science-informed policy debates that you mentioned, like climate or, you know, drug approvals and so on, is the presence of adversarial behavior, or the worry about adversarial behavior. And I think the, you know, typical mindset in cryptography, computer security, is that if there is a vulnerability, it will be exploited, which ends up being a sort of a qualitative statement rather than a something that can be experimentally measured in the way that some of these other things are. So do you have thoughts on how thinking about adversarial behavior, worries, predictions about adversarial behavior should play a role or come into these policy debates?
That's a really interesting point. I think that a lot of the complexity in the interaction between people who really come from a computer security or cryptography background, who've then brought those issues to privacy questions, to kind of individual privacy questions, is the tension between the traditional security notion of a presumably very powerful, ultimately malicious adversary, to something that's a little more complicated in the consumer privacy world, where there is a threat of some sort, but it's a threat that is probably in the form of a corporation that has some legal obligations which you could dial up or dial down. And so it's a very interesting observation. What I would say, so I was actually going to point to the work on differential privacy, and which I think is kind of an answer to your question in a certain way, in that it provides a measure of a certain kind of risk of exposure, right, which is independent from any prediction about whether that whether anyone will make an effort to expose the individual in that way. It just says, here's the risk you face based on an empirically quite well-defined risk or sort of potential attack. And I think I think that the differential privacy work that you and Cynthia and others have done is an incredibly important model for lots of other work in this area, because it does create a model that and it creates some measures that we can actually apply to an environment and say, how much risk do you want to take? We can measure it, we can quantify it, and then there's a policy decision. I think the ultimate answer to your question is, there's always a policy judgment about how big the risk is and how much effort you have to put in to mitigate against the risk. I don't believe there's, in the end, a technical answer to that question, as you suggest. But I think what's really important is to be able to put some formal, rigorous bounds on what the effect of the risk might be. Then there are judgment calls. I'm not saying we get rid of those, but I think we can reduce the what I think of as the ultimately sort of ideological judgments that are inserted and make more clear decisions. It's a really good question, though.
Great. Thanks.
Thanks. Hi.
Hi. Very interesting points on the net neutrality work, I think. I wanted to sort of dig in a little bit more there and also talk about point number one here in that context. I would sort of argue that actually, I mean, the measurement work, as you point out, is quite difficult in and of itself. I mean, we've done a bunch of that ourselves. We have similar kind of graphs. But actually, as it turns out, I think in that particular area, the measurements are almost the easy part. because I mean, the congestion is there. We can see it. We can measure it. That part is not debatable. We can even figure out where it is. The interesting part there, though, is the arguments that are on both sides, right? Netflix is basically saying, look, we pay for transit to Comcast to reach its customers through these transit ISPs, and Comcast is letting the links congest. Now, Comcast on the other side is saying Netflix is sending the traffic on these different transit ISPs to intentionally congest the link. Both of these, and therefore they should pay, right? And that's basically paid peering.
Right.
Both of these things are actually correct,
right?
And the measurements are not debatable, right? And when we basically presented similar stuff to the FCC about a month ago, they were like, yeah, the technical stuff is all nice here, but to come back to Jeremy's point, who should pay? They basically just, okay, tell us who should pay. And that's a tough question, and that's not something that actually I think myself or a lot of people in this room are equipped to, you know, to think about. And every time I sort of take these kind of studies to the FCC, I get this wake-up call that, like, wow, measurement, as you point out here, it's important, but also it's incredibly political, right? Just a simple question like, how do you measure the throughput of an access link, which you'd think is a technical question, is actually political, because it's like, well, where do you put the server? Do you put it on net or off net? When do you measure? Do you measure with parallel TCP connections? Do you let the connections warm up? Blah, 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 blah. And we know all the nuances and ramifications of these things, but then there are these other people in the room, and I don't think it's a matter of we need to educate them. I actually think they know what's going on, and they basically have an agenda, right? It's like, well, look, if we put the servers here, that's basically going to be more favorable. So in those kinds of situations, I'm coming to my question, which is, what do we do about this? But I often don't think it's a matter so much of, my perception is not so much a matter of education, because we all know, like, we can do the measurements, we can explain them, these people often understand them, but the question is, who should pay or what should happen? And then you've got these people who really actually do know what they're talking about on both sides of the issue, and it's sort of like, you're in a legal battle, or like you can take these facts and present them in this way or that way. And now you've got technical people who, by the way, take gift money from Comcast or Netflix or Cisco or whoever, and they're being asked to, well, what do you think about the technical? Well, the technical stuff isn't actually debatable. It's basically, well, look, these guys are presenting it this way, these guys are presenting it this way, and they're actually both right. So what do we do?
That's a great question, and it's a little bit, I think it's actually parallel to Salil's question, which is, I mean, you're sort of hypothesizing, well, I'll try to answer your question then, so I think it's parallel. I do think that, first of all that we're able to measure, all that, you know, Dave and Casey were able to measure, all that you're able to measure is the traffic. You're actually not able to measure the cost or who pays whom.
Right.
So that's completely opaque.
Or the intentions, right? Like you read the FCC file, and it's Comcast is intentionally letting links congest.
Intentions, hopefully, you know, I think in policy you've got to worry about effect more than intent.
Okay.
Except in unusual cases like, you know, discrimination against protected categories. So I really do think you have to look at effect. I think that by bringing more of a empirical focus to these questions, at least what you do is you narrow down where the actual policy judgments are from everything else. I don't think that. And you know, you can go beyond just the look at these links and say, well, interestingly, at least again, this is just purely based on Dave and Casey's work. What they found using these same techniques is that for the most part, there was no other persistent congestion anywhere, like anywhere they could find on. I mean, they didn't obviously look on the entire global internet, but they looked pretty far and wide across national boundaries, and that right away. Is useful to a policymaker to say, well, somehow everyone else has worked out this problem, except you two. so that would at least get regulators at the FCC to do what they are actually doing, which is to go and say, well, we want to know what the pricing arrangements are here, so I think what your kind of work could do is to narrow the policy questions to what are really policy judgments, as opposed to assumptions about what the facts are, and I think that helps a lot.
That's useful. Thanks.
So I think I have maybe a blunter version of this question, which I think the reason there was such a public uprising over SOPA and net neutrality is the perception of the public is that these laws are written in dark rooms somewhere not too far from here, where lobbyists paid by these big profitable companies go to congressional staffers who know nothing about the internet, and they write a law for them and say, you know, let's get this in place. And when these things sometimes get noticed by the general public, then there's this uprising and sense that, yeah, the government is not looking out for the interests of the public, but is being manipulated by these companies, and because of lack of understanding at different levels of the government, these things are getting to a stage far further than they should without really understanding what they mean. So I'm hoping you can both convince me that my perception and other people's perception that that's the way government works is not true from your experience at the White House, or if it is true, what hope is there for a technical community having influence that can compete with the resources that these big companies that have vested interests have?
So that's a really good question. I guess what I'd say, first of all, just about the way the White House works, the Hill is different. I think that any well-run White House, Democrat or Republican, does actually make a real effort to separate policy and politics. So a lot of the decision-making process in the White House on whatever issue is actually designed to learn as much about an issue as possible, including learning who the different stakeholders, constituencies, agitators are on both sides, but to really try to understand what's the clearest policy view we can have of what makes sense here and how to approach an issue. There is then a political decision, and there's a sort of 80-20 or probably 95-5 rule that applies. A huge amount of time gets spent on the policy side, and then there's a pretty quick political decision, which takes all that into account, and it may take into account, who's friends with whom, without a doubt. I mean, I don't factor that out, but there's an effort at least And I've seen Democratic and Republican White Houses, and the ones that work well that both all do this. And when they don't work well, they all don't do this. You know. I think there's a broader and I think more nebulous set of questions about campaign finance and lobbying and all this sort of stuff. And some people have decided for themselves that that's the whole question now, that there's nothing you can do until you fix that entire process. And I am not of that school at all, because I think that I think governments tend to have people who tend to be well-meaning. They have their ideologies, but they aren't really there for purely nefarious or venal purposes. and again, this is a bipartisan statement. I think it's possible to influence the policy side of the debate with good research. And that's what I'm suggesting is important that people in this room can contribute to. I don't discount the effect of politics, the effect of money. It's all there. But, you know, all you have to do is look at the climate change debate. I mean, there's a lot more money spent on the side of doing nothing about climate change. A lot more political money spent on that side than on the side of doing something. It happens that a lot of the public is actually pretty concerned about it. So in the end, you know, well-articulated, organized public pressure, I think, can always stand up to money. That's been my experience. But it has to be well-organized, and it ultimately has to have the facts behind it. And again, that's where I think this matters. So I don't want to gloss over anything you're saying. I think they're all real concerns, but I don't think that means we should throw up our hands, because I still think there's a lot of avenue to make progress.
Thank you.
Hi.
Hello. So I'll bring this different direction round to back to education. So we had a panel on this yesterday, and there's this continuous contention that there are literally only so many hours in an undergraduate education, and we can't put absolutely everything into it.
And we use them all perfectly efficiently, right?
Oh, yes. We get them all into security courses. You know, it's vital. It's important. We do that the first year, you know, all of that sort of stuff. But I'm curious, because I think you are right. I think it's important that technologists have a better understanding of some of these policy issues. But what sorts of things do you think that we should be highlighting for, say, an undergraduate education versus how much should we be bringing into, for example, graduate level education, where they're more likely to run into these types of decisions?
You know, look, even though I've spent, you know, close to 20 years in a engineering computer science environment, I'm a fish out of water. I'm a lawyer. And, you know, but what I observe about engineers is ultimately they design systems to optimize for certain purposes. They have certain functional expectations of systems, and that seems to me what engineering is about, is engineering systems for a set of purposes. We have a certain set of purposes that we expect as the fundamental properties of computer systems. Again, what I really like about things like the differential privacy work is it brings into the kind of the formal systems understanding the ability to account for what are basically policy properties, policy functions. So I think part of it is just presenting these problems as engineering problems. How does the DNS work? What would happen if 10% of the people left their name servers and went somewhere else? That's a pretty interesting systems engineering question. People should work on it. That's not telling people you have to go off and learn how the United States Senate works in order, you know, to affect policy. That's really so I think we can do a lot to just expand the topics from a systems and engineering perspective. I think that's one thing. My impression again is that I think good engineering education is part driven by where our students are going to go work and what they're going to be expected to do, and I think they're expected to do more and more of this. So again, presenting these problems in the context, not as a kind of a you know, one-off, it would be nice if you were an ethical person kind of a thing, which is important too. But again, I think making it more of a core challenge, as has happened in security in a lot of ways, right, I think is something that we can really do, whether it's in network engineering courses for net neutrality questions or, you know, any of these other topics. So I guess I'm a fan of integrating as much into the main line of a CS and engineering curriculum as you can. I mean, that's at least the way we're thinking about it at MIT, and I think it works because it exposes students to these questions, but gives them a way to apply the skills they have to these topics. All right. Oh, hi, Carl.
So I apologize for having missed your talk. Metro wasn't running quite so well this morning, and I don't have. So I have no. This may be completely out of context, but I gather the last question had to do with how do you teach engineers about policy. So let me invert the question, since I'm somewhat confronted with this problem personally. What would you teach non-engineers about the engineering?
I think. That's a really good question. I think I'd do whatever I could to help non-engineers get their hands on the ability to build any piece of code at all. I think it's important to have your hands on it, and it's easier and easier to do that, as you know. I'm not saying you should hand people a C, IDE and say go to town, but you know, give them something like App Inventor, or it's easier and easier to build to build up code bases, and I think doing that is just really useful. I think it's probably somewhat more useful than sort of hard to get your hands around lectures about, you know, here are all the components of the internet. I don't think those resonate very well. I think hands-on is a good thing to do, and I think we can. Yeah, it's easier.
So I'll try take another shot at your measurement angle. As we know, there's a lot of junk science out there in all fields of science, not specifically computer science. How do we help the policymakers, decision makers, differentiate between real science and junk science in this field in particular, where, you know, they don't know how to, as I think was Nick was saying, they don't know how to understand what questions to even ask about the data they're being presented in the measurements?
Well, I think that, as I said, I think it's important to start to deploy the core academic institutions that we have. You know, we have curricula in which we decide what's in and what's out. We have research expectations. We have publication processes. We have conferences, all of which define, you know, what are the worthwhile questions to ask. And then hopefully we have a peer review system that isn't completely broken and you know, is at least a reasonable filter.
Well, we have that, But to a policymaker, the difference between the Journal of Left-Handed Widgets and Internet Measurement is indistinguishable from the IEEE Journal on whatever.
Right. So I think that speaks to the immaturity of the field and the fact that no one. I mean, for example, I come back to the climate change example. Right. This gets debated all the time. You know, the source of research, the funding for research, the technical quality of research in climate change is a big topic. I mean, there are congressional hearings about it, and hopefully we can get to that point. Like, hopefully we can be having those kind of arguments where people are saying, well, that view of the DNS is completely wrong because the data was wrong or the analysis was incorrect or whatever because it's contradicted by 10 other studies. That's where we should aim to be. Again, it's not like our research process is going to produce the one true answer. Mm-hmm. to any policy question, but it will inform the debate. And I can tell you, you know, I desperately looked when we were in the SOPA debate for something more than a letter from a bunch of my friends who are engineers. And there wasn't anything, and it's a real problem. Yeah. It may be baby steps for a little while, but I think we're at a point where the issues are of broad enough concern that, you know, I know you guys would fund good research in this area, and then we set in motion a process of professionalizing it, and that will help.
I think we've got to get to the point where, to point to what Carl was saying about teaching them about what engineers do. A case I was recently involved in, again, not NSF, where the state of Virginia said that they were going to do internet voting and it was only going to cost $4,000 a year to do it securely, because that's all it costs to do secure internet voting, right. Was $4,000 a year.
Right. And you know, I think you mentioned the voting example before. I think that's a great example of a success in this area. You know, it became a real field of study for a while because of all the problems, 10 years ago or whenever that was. I think there are models for doing this well.
So I'll try again at another angle on the measurement challenge. So, and you mentioned this in your talk, and that, you know, so there's a lot of great research that's going on in the community and measurement. Nick and others have been doing it, but as researchers, we're typically limited to what we can observe publicly. Yeah. And there's lots of really important things that we need access that we can't easily measure. And this is particularly true in security, right? Because the incentives are often aligned in the way that you shouldn't. There's not an interest to talk about what goes wrong. And so I'm interested, what role do you think policy has in trying to correct some of this? And do you think there's any prospects for that? Or should, you know, maybe as researchers focus on the situations where we can actually get aligned incentives with parties to actually willingly share more information that we could use?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think that, so I think you heard from Dan Geer yesterday, was that right? And so he probably talked about his public health, you know, mandatory reporting analogy. Did he?
No.
Oh, he didn't talk about that.
He was
okay.
On a whole.
Okay, different. He was a different track. Okay.
Different stuff.
I think where you were going is exactly what I think makes sense. I think that it seems like there are some successes in getting enterprises or even groups of enterprises in a sector to be willing to share more sensitive security data with researchers in a controlled way. I think there's people in the financial services sector are pretty interested in doing this because they obviously can look at their own institution's experience, but they don't have a way to look across their sector, and that produces value. And my sense is that if we can get some of those kinds of private sharing collaborations going and show results from those, I think that would both reduce the fear from various commercial sectors in sharing more, and would also encourage policymakers that it's actually worthwhile. And of course, there's a lot of ways to share that are somewhat short of completely transparent. I'm interested in your sense of whether we should go to a sort of a radical transparency view of incident reporting, or whether we ought to maintain some kind of boundaries. But there are obviously ways to share just with regulators. There's ways to share in protected contexts. There's ways to share with certain kinds of obfuscation. I think, frankly, that the security research community is the one that should be leading that discussion, be saying, here's what we need to know, here's an example of what we can do if we get it, and here's why the risks of sharing are, you know, whatever you think.
Yeah, so I think it kind of depends on you what day I'm on, whether I think, whether I'm optimistic that a voluntary approach would be sufficient. And I think in some contexts, maybe it is where you have, like in the financial sector, that they actually see credible return value in doing it. I think there are going to persistently be areas where you won't necessarily see that value. And I think, and you may actually need to consider some mandatory disclosure in those cases. But I'm cognizant that there can be indirect costs to trying to disclosing everything that goes wrong, and you can just end up causing people to be scared to use the internet and this sort of thing. So I think, maybe a model where you disclose your regulators could be more feasible in some circumstances.
I think it's an open question even today. What's been the impact of the security breach notification rules that we have in the books today in states, in whatever, 47 states around the country? But I think clearly this is a question that policymakers are thinking about and will continue to think about. And from a somewhat cynical perspective, I'd say it's going to be a lot easier for them to put in place some sort of reporting mechanism than to actually start putting into place a mechanism that penalizes companies for bad behavior.
The
companies would probably be happier with that, too. So I think everyone recognizes this is kind of a necessary first step. Whether it's sufficient or not, hard to tell. But I think the question is what, not whether, on this reporting. And again, I really think that because of the uncertainty about this and because of the real concerns of risk about disclosure that could end up helping adversaries more than anyone else, I think this community can do a huge amount to help kind of guide the policy process through those questions. I think it's a really good topic.
Thank you.
Let's thank Dan again for a very provocative and interesting talk.
Thanks. Nice to see you.